And from here, I can see we have five people with us on Zoom this morning. If we were a bit simple and a bit literalist, this passage might just disturb us a little bit. Because here we read about someone called John the Baptist. There are Baptists in the Bible. I don't find any Anglicans. We might lose sleep over that. So why are there Baptists in the Bible? What's going on here? 4 years ago, Barbara and I got to do an archaeological tour of the Bible lands in Israel and Jordan. And next screen, please. Archaeology is about digging up the past from the ground. It's exciting. One feature that gets brought up again and again and again in Israel from the first century time are ritual washing pools. Got a picture of one up there. So in Hebrew, they're referred to as mikveh, which is not an Irish surname only, but mikveh. And in the plural, mikvah. They're everywhere. If you were a first century plumber, this was a good line. Private ritual bathing pools and public ones. Now, this is an age before sanitation, before people were concerned about germs and bugs, and people were quite happy to share cups. That was okay. There was no anxiety about anything like that. So what's going on? Why this washing cult? Why so many Baptists around the place? The explanation is in ritual cleansing. It's about doing what we often do, which is an outward action for an inward purpose. So people washed as part of prayer. Cleanse me, purify me. May I be washed of my sins before God. That sort of prayer, which is very familiar to us, cleanse me, was acted out often. And if you were a priest or anyone involved in leading worship, you washed a lot. And if you had the means, you had a mikveh in your home. Next screen, please. That's the one, yes. So there's another one. So I kid you not, every time the ground is disturbed where people lived in the first century, they're there in large number. People were washing away their guilt and their shame as an enacted prayer to the God of Israel. Now, Yohanan bar Zechariah, or John the Baptist, rose to tell people that it was time to now seriously practice this. That prayer, that enacted prayer, was for this time, because God was about to do something new, very, very new, and you had to be ready. Yes, you've been expecting it for centuries, but it's coming. It's time to scrub up. And he drew people to the region of the Jordan, where he preached and prepared them for the washing of their guilt. It's a very hot place. Next screen, please. So this picture shows the area where this is believed to have happened. And Barbara and I had the privilege of being there. There's quite a bit of water in the picture that you can see on the screen. When we saw it, it didn't have much water. This is not the Jordan River. These are like overflow pools or places where the water would overflow, and there'd be just the sort of dips and depressions that would be ideal for baptizing people. And of course, churches and shelters and structures have been built there in the centuries since. But that's where everyone points to. That's where John baptized, because there was much water there. Now, what I'm interested in here, because so far this is a bit of sort of Barbara and Francis travel tales and Sunday school background and pictures to tell, that's good. But what I'm interested in here is how John was preparing people for something new, really new. God was about to move, and he was waking them up and washing them down. I want to explore that space, that dynamic, and I want us to somehow put some toes in the water there. Now, the end result of this Baptist story is that Jesus gains disciples. Starts off with the inquisitors coming from Jerusalem to check out John. Who are you? What are you doing here? John saying a few things, and at the end, disciples go to Jesus. It's fascinating. People who had been disciples of John transferred to become disciples of Jesus and even brought others with them. Now, this is something of great interest to us, right? People becoming disciples of Jesus. So where to begin? A little investigation. Here are my reflections. And reflections means I've thought about where this touches me, where it resonates with other things that I hold. And I'm going to put them together and try and bless you with it. So I want to start with some wisdom, a line attributed to Solomon that's often quoted. There is nothing new under the sun. Now, I see a lot of gray silver hair out there. I'm coming to the party. There is nothing new under the sun. It's what a wizened old man or woman who's seen it all says. Show me something new I haven't seen. It's all happened. It's worth reading this passage, Ecclesiastes 1, 9 to 10. Just listen to the tone. It's beautiful. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. Now, if we had a spare hour, we could talk about just how this sets us up for circular thinking. And we could talk about the myth of progress that sort of dawned at the end of the 19th century, where technology and learning suggested to people, actually, we're going into a new age. There's a new age coming. It's exciting. But it never quite works out. It's just the old with more technology. But this passage, this is the world-weary view of an old man who's seen it all. There's nothing new under the sun. Don't tell me something new is coming. Yeah, right. It's been done before. That feeds the mind of a conservative. You may want to check now. Are you a conservative? Just check. What will be. Don't expect any real change. And suspect anyone who says otherwise. They're selling you a porky. We'll come back to conservatism later. As I was running yesterday, I was reflecting on this, running down Kaikorai Valley as I do, and it occurred to me, God is not under the sun. God is beyond the sun. He acts from beyond the sun, out of the box, so to speak, beyond the cosmos. God is capable of doing something new. And it was one of the themes that kept emerging in our church prayer meetings last year. Behold, I do something new. And that reflection popped up. New. God doing something new. God's creativity is not bound or limited by what has happened before or what is. Not, doesn't need to be part of a sequence that we recognize. And in my reading, this is something John is trying to instill in people as he preached and baptized. Look, there really is something new coming. Wash away the old. Stand clean and ready to be surprised. Get ready. Now, I suppose I'm in the people business. It's something we people find quite difficult. We tend to think in boxes. And we go through education systems in the West that really reinforce this. Chris, you people have a lot to answer for. Inductive logic is everything. We think in terms of what is and what has been. Something new, something really out of the box, genuinely. Is it possible? Is it safe? Our boxes are made up of all the things we've experienced, or at least we know about. And as I've said, it's a very Western inductive thing. We're quite committed to it. So when we're told that God is going to do what only God can do, we may have a problem. It's in our heads. Next screen, please. Last century had a few theological superstars. This guy may claim pole position. Karl Barth. Does anyone have Karl Barth on their bedside table? Just read a little Karl Barth before you nod off. John, you're smiling. One of his best and most quoted lines came out of the context of World War I, where as a German theologian, he saw all the liberal theologians of his day going with the Kaiser's war effort. Bit like some Orthodox voices in Russia today. And he realized that the problem was that what had developed was a version of God who was just a bigger version of ourselves. Projection, big sky daddy. And so he said in German, of course, but translated it is, God is not man writ large. And that remains a huge challenge to a lot of theology and a lot of thinking. God is not simply a bigger, better, flawless version of ourselves. Is that new? No. No, it's not new. God is God, holy, other, incomparable. But that doesn't stop us trying to use words and to talk about God. Karl Barth spent a lot of words in his so-called dogmatics. So John the Baptist has his work cut out as a prophet, preparing the way for Jesus to come as God with us. Something entirely new. You've all seen Christmas come and go so many times. Yada, yada, yada. Incarnation, God with us. That was an unknown possibility when John was speaking. So how do you get across that God is about to do something entirely, utterly new in your backyard? What I see John doing, as I stayed with that question, is running with a mix of the familiar on one hand and destroying the familiar on the other. In teaching, I was told, you start with the familiar and then you move to the new on a basis. John has the familiar and then he kind of destroys the familiar. He's a deconstructionist way before postmodernism. So here's the familiar. Next one, please. He comes baptizing, just a click away from what everyone's doing already, washing at their pools, at their mikveh. He bases himself in the wilderness, Israel's birthplace. You want to do anything new, you go back to the birthplace. He's born in the desert. He ministers at the Jordan, Israel's point of crossing, a point of decision, a point of commitment that resonated in his story. And he comes as a prophet, a hairy, bony man with a craggy finger, which Israel hasn't seen for 400 years, but remembers. And people whisper, might this be Elijah? That's all familiar. Those are categories and things in the mind and the imagination. Has a business as usual feel to it. We've seen this before, not for a long time, but we know this stuff. Voices that speak God to us. But then he says two things that I want to open up. Firstly, we read, he saw Jesus coming towards him and declared, here is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. When had God last provided a lamb? Sunday school question. You get a gold star for this one. When had God last provided a lamb? That's my answer. Isaac, carry the wood up the hill. And at the top, God provides a lamb in his place. Deep resonance was when Abraham was stopped from killing Isaac. And we'll hear again in John's gospel, this is God's lamb for the world to cleanse it. It will take a lamb to save God's people as it did for Isaac and the people in Egypt under Moses. But this lamb is for the world. The entire human family, all the nations and all the peoples in creation. All the boundaries of exclusivity are blown away. Something's going to happen in your backyard that is of global, historic, eternal significance. God has provided a lamb who is walking among you. I've seen him, and it's for the world. That's new. Very new. Mind-blowing and unprecedented. But then John says something else, which again blows the familiar apart. This is of whom I said, after me comes a man who ranks ahead of me because he was before me. Now we have really gone somewhere different, and Solomon might be spinning in his tomb. In any traditional family, anywhere on earth, you respect your ancestors. In Māoritanga, your tipuna. They're acknowledged, they're honored. And within this respect, there is often a belief that they are greater than you will ever be. And everything in terms of people and culture and history is going downhill. Generation by generation, we're sliding downwards. Our ancestors, they give us life. Our being is ground in their being, and they're greater than us. They're classic and mighty, so much so that some people pray to them, or at least formally always pay respects. Now, this is the ground of conservatism and the belief that well-being is about maintaining the past or even recreating it. Can't we go back to 1970 when petrol was less than a dollar a gallon? Just go back. Do you remember how it was with Jesus and the woman at the well when she reminded him, hang on, smart Jewish preacher guy from Jerusalem, our ancestor Jacob, he's the great one. You can't think you're better than him. It's the same ballpark. When God does something new, it transcends that. So John says, not so now, when he deconstructs this. After me comes a man who ranks ahead of me because he was before me. Now, you may hear something referring to the pre-existing Christ as the Son of God, but he was born after John and would follow in the road that John had prepared. When God does something new, it's not limited by the past. That's what John is saying. And John was so onto this. He so understood that he must increase and I must decrease. So why so obtuse and hard on the brain here? You know, Zen has no monopoly on the power of contradiction or the shattering of thought. This is a way of breaking up the rigid thinking. It cannot cope with God's new thing. I used to have a gardening book, Brett's Gardening Guide. Does that ring a bell in anyone? It's mine. Oh, yes. It does. I don't know how I got it. I think I got it from one of Barbara's grandparents. It was a green cloth-covered book published in 1940. What do you do in New Zealand if you have firm, hard clay? You dig a hole and you put some dynamite down it. Can you imagine this? A gardening book that says this is how you deal with hard clay. New Zealand, 1940. So I have some spare dynamite in the shed. That'll fix it. The reason that comes to mind just now is same with stuck thinking, stuck mind. How do you break that up? Take some heavy force. So these two statements have upended all confidence in knowing what God might be about to do next. Oh, yes, the Almighty will do what he did last time. And all will be well again. That's a restoration mentality. No, something entirely new is coming. Conservatives don't know where to go with this. And this would play out again and again for Jesus. And ultimately, lead him to the cross. God was doing a new thing instead of repairing what was. Is a very strange place. So, what do you do when the message lands that God is doing a new thing? What if that exciting, disturbing conviction comes? Well, I have a few thoughts. The first thing is you do not try to manage it. Let it go. I got to see some very wise leaders in recent years respond to unexpected developments. And some of them would stroke their chin and say, this might be God. I wouldn't have planned it this way. Or I wouldn't have chosen him or her, but it might be God. Let's play out some line. Let's give it some space. Let's stand back. From the gospel story itself, I take a few tips. What to do when this conviction lands or this tantalizing impression that God might be doing something new. The first thing is keep your eyes and your ears open. Look and listen. Look. Watch. Behold. John tells it this way. I saw the Spirit descending from heaven as like a dove, and it remained on him. I myself did not know him, but the one who sent me to baptize with water said to me, he on whom you see the Spirit descend and remain is the one who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. So John saw things and he listened to God's commentary. Now, I just love this. This is deep in the prophetic tradition of Israel. Amos is my classic. What do you see, Amos? Oh, I see a wall. I see a wall. Talk to me, God. What does that mean? There are things that catch our eye. There are people that catch our eye. There are moments that command our attention. Stop. Give time to God to comment on it. What am I seeing? It's Moses in the burning bush. This is weird. Stop. Listen for God's commentary. If you look carefully in church, out in the world, you can sometimes sense God's spirit with a person, alighting on a person. And the language in this passage that points to that and is typically missed is that I saw the spirit descending from heaven like a dove. Now, this usually is taken visually. Oh, Holy Spirit comes like a bird. And all the painters have painted these doves. Okay, understand that. But the language actually isn't talking about what the spirit looks like. You may anticipate the language is pointing to the downward draft of flapping wings. It's the wind. I stood there as if a little fan, a little zephyr, a wind was felt. A disturbance in the atmosphere. That's what doves do. And if you're brave enough to sit underneath them, when they descend, that's what you may feel. The fingerprints of God's activity may be seen on people. Then listen for what God tells you about them. This is new territory. I see something I don't understand. Stop. Watch, listen. Okay. Francis, let's try that. Second tip that comes from this passage is follow Jesus and ask him questions. Assume nothing. Assume nothing. One of the experiences of shifting location, first going 20 years ago to Europe and now coming back, is that you come with a toolbox and at least half your tools don't work. They don't work. It's quite unsettling. I thought I knew how to do this. Even in very basic handyman terms or tradesman terms, I come back. And the whole range of screws and fittings and such like in New Zealand has changed in 20 years. You go to Mitre 10, it's different stock from what it was. That's representative of how things have changed. Assume nothing. So it is with God's new thing. Our existing tools often don't apply. Two disciples heard him say this. This is referring to what John just said. And they followed Jesus. When Jesus turned and saw them following, he said to them, "What are you looking for?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which translated means teacher, literally my great one. "Where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and see." They came and saw where he was staying, and they remained with him that day. Jesus received disciples from John, and then Andrew brought in his brothers. The point, God doing new things requires new discipleship. Which brings the story right here into this church, which has a strap line. Growing disciples of Jesus. I didn't make that up. That's inherited. That was a really... the letterhead and the logo. God doing a new thing requires retooling and new learning. Disciples are learners, people being formed in a new reality. We are learners because we don't know, because we're ignorant. God's doing a new thing. And these disciples who'd come from John went to Jesus because they wanted to be in this new thing. They wanted to be learning, training, and they didn't know. Be our teacher, Jesus. So John prompted his disciples to follow Jesus and to learn from him because they didn't know what it was all about. If we claim to know what it's all about, oh, this new thing, oh, yes, I can anticipate it's going to be A, B, C, and this is what you do, and da, 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 da. We'll actually go back to the old thing, just revisit it. Embracing that ignorance, that need to learn, requires courage, patience, an absence of fear. What's going on? I don't know. I don't know, but I'm going to learn. And that's the faith Jesus seeks. We turn up with a whole lot of tools that don't work, and he retools us. Fear and impatience drive God's people to the place where we think God wants yesterday back, because the tension of being ignorant for the new thing of today is too much. We knew where we were yesterday. The last great thing God did, that's wonderful. Just replay it. Can we go back there? That's not discipleship. Discipleship is I'm standing in ignorance and the need to grow and to learn and to be reformed, to be transformed. And it's not an age thing. It's not as if we disciple the children and the youth, and then somewhere around their 30s, they sort of level out and they're sorted. When God's doing a new thing, whatever age you are, I feel an Abraham sermon coming on, but I'll resist. You become disciples with a capital D. Never too old to be a disciple. There is a place for conservation, for conservatism even. Holding to truth and goodness. Hold it. It has a place. But you can be so on that end of the spectrum, holding, that you're not open or free to the new thing that is happening. There is a place for liberalism, for liberation and breaking free from what God did yesterday to flow in God's new thing today. This tension has been compared to salt, which both preserves the substance and liberates the flavor. Conserving and liberating. Now, the impact of this was clearly seen in Simon that day when Andrew brought his brother to Jesus for the first time. And we read, Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You are to be called Cephas," which translates Peter. So Jesus recognized him for who he was, deeper than anyone else had done. And in that recognition, he gave him a new future, a new destiny. People have called you Simon, which I think Simeon is a sign, but you're going to be a rock. And that's the transformation that will be happening in your discipleship in this new thing. Coming into land now, it has been said, and I don't know how many of you have experienced revivals or big moves of God or anything like that. Nothing fights the new thing that God is doing as fiercely as the institutionalized version of what God did yesterday. Nothing fights the new thing that God is doing as the institutionalized version of what God did yesterday. God initiates, people tend to perpetuate. And there's a tension there, even in the life of the church. We saw it classically in the battle of the organ and the guitar, which happily doesn't run here, but it ran for previous decades. I believe, for various reasons, that God is doing a new thing in our day. And I'm personally very challenged by it because my toolbox is for yesterday, pre-COVID times, attractional church, international church. That's on one level, but on a much bigger level, it's just so obvious that the way God used to work, he isn't working. So he's working in a new way. What we need to do is to look, listen, and let go of the old things. Look, listen, and let go of the old things. Hold on to what is good, but more importantly, remain free to flow with God's new thing today. That's my message. Epiphany 2, third Sunday of the year. God's doing a new thing. Let's be free to flow with it.